Hi everyone. Obviously, I'm not Doug Cook, but I don't know him, so maybe it's not obvious. I don't know. But I'm going to talk. We've heard these great talks now about the global and national initiatives, how to conserve and use crop wild relatives. I'm going to talk about a very specific initiative where that's been based at the University of Minnesota, a very specific regional initiative that's now been growing. And I see a couple people here who are part of it. I'll give a shout out to Zhao Fei right there. And I apologize, this also turned out a lot more red than I thought it would be. It looked on my computer a little more maroon. And this is probably like the last talk I get to give as a member, as part of the University of Minnesota. So I was really excited to be able to do a maroon and gold theme, but it didn't really work out. But so what I'm going to talk about is, you know, these interdisciplinary collaborations and how we've used them to try and develop new crops, and also how we can reimagine using some traditional crops. And while my name's here, there's, you know, tons and tons of people involved. And actually, the guy whose brainchild this is Don Weiss, right up there. Picture's a little bit small, but he's looking at intermediate wheatgrass up there. And this is part of a program that he's developed called the Forever Green Initiative. And its main goals are to develop continuous living color programs to really enhance agriculture's contribution to ecosystem services. And this really means focusing on perennials, winter annuals, and various polycultures. Really, it falls in the idea of sustainable intensification. How can we get more out of our landscapes? And what this has led to, it's a collaboration now that at the University of Minnesota has over 15 different departments. There's five different private enterprises, including Patagonia, General Mills, Aveda, Estee Lauder, as well as various farmer co-ops. Breeding programs have been initiated in 10 different species, and there's also half a dozen universities in the U.S. and also one in Canada now that are participating in this initiative that have grown out of this idea of sustainable intensification. I know one of the things Colin brought up was the idea of declining public research funding. So one of the things I'm going to talk about, and well, there's a few things. One, all of these species are crop wild relatives. That's basically how we started, you know, thinking about, okay, when we live in a different ecological niche, we know that we have a lot of the desirable characteristics of crops and crop wild relatives. So then the question is, do we cross in those, or do we do domestication in these new species? And we've done a combination of both, depending on what those, depending on what we want from those species and how good those wild species are for the different uses that we want. So, but in the vein of trying to understand how can we get more people involved, how can you start a regional program, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this project got funded and how it became, six different universities, six different public-private partnerships, 15 departments within a single university, right? How did that gain traction and gain leverage? Well, it starts by kind of looking at what farms used to look like and getting this message out. So this is a county in Iowa in 1941. You see a really diverse farmscape here. Lots and lots of different crops, mix of plant and animal agriculture. But this is really the farm of the past. This is prior to World War II or during World War II. If we look at this same county, 40 years ago, we're already reducing tremendously what we're seeing. And this is really only moving towards the farm of today, right? Now we're even less integrated than we were then. You're not going to be seeing oats now on in Iowa, right? And even you look at the University of Minnesota, there's not an oat breeding program anymore. There'd been an oat breeding program for 150 years, and there's no longer an oat breeding program, although they're trying to restart it, you know. So this has also led, with these lack of diversification of the decreasing diversity on farms, it's led to a lack of ground cover, right? So what you're seeing now is that upper Mississippi River Basin late April, early May, and you're seeing a huge chunk in these satellite photos. No plant cover. No plant cover at all, right? And then it gets better over the course of the year. We're moving, you know. I get my fancy animations. I get really excited about them. But then in July, like, it looks great. You know, we have all this plant cover. It's really, really good. But then again, in October, we're starting to lose that. So for half the, we only have ground cover for half the year. So what are some of the environmental consequences? Well, the most obvious is we end up getting a lot of erosion, right? And so that's detrimental for a lot of reasons. But then one of the main ones is water quality. We end up with this hypoxic zone, and we end up with a huge amount of nitrogen flowing and contaminating groundwater all through that system. So Don likes to tell a story. We're in Minneapolis. So this story actually makes sense. We're downtown. You guys see the new Viking stadium that they're building? So the stadium, one of the major funders of this project has been the Minnesota state government. The state loses in nitrogen runoff, loses about $100 million a year in nitrogen that is put on and then just runs off. So Don went down to the legislature, he's testifying before the state senate, and he says, the stadium costs $1 billion. They didn't put a retractable roof on, right? So he said, well, if you had just done a better job conserving nitrogen and dealing with the crops here, you could build a new stadium every 10 years with a retractable roof. And all of a sudden the state senate goes, really? And like all of a sudden they start really caring, and you know, everyone's really into now the idea of funding these new plant breeding projects. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting way of, we go from a really recognizable problem, water quality, that resonates with everyone, to tying it back there, and now you're getting these 10 breeding programs funded, at least in the short term. It's a, you know, it's a fun story. But really, right, what does this come down to? It's ecosystem services. We want more, especially in these agriculture regions, we want more out of our landscapes and our ecosystems now. We do great getting food. We have a lot of cheap food. We're getting fiber, but we want more. We want to have pollinators. We want to have wildlife. We want to have better nutrient cycling. We care about sustainability, and that's where you can really convince a lot of, in this case, in Minnesota, right? You can convince a large investment in new breeding programs. So really, I talk about utilizing crop wild relatives. So you can see the wheat, right, is right on the St. Paul campus, rapeseed, sunflower. So three of the ones that have really taken off now are intermediate wheatgrass. Actually, Xiaofei is the main breeder working on intermediate wheatgrass over there. Pennycress has great oil properties. And then perennial sunflower. One of the main ways that we started this was look at the crop wild relatives, and also actually quite a bit of ethnobotany at the beginning to start looking at what, you know, not only crop wild relatives, but maybe abandoned domesticates as well, things that had use. So I'm going to lay out a little bit of an example with the perennial sunflower to see how we started this program and how we've maintained it. So, right here, in this case, a perennial sunflower, you're trying to develop these, a perennial system to get the same oil seed, the same oil you can get off, but continuous cover, and also additional wildlife habitat, additional pollinators, right? So, I start here with two different species, Helianthus annuus and Helianthus tuberosus. But that's not actually how the program started. The program started by taking annual sunflower and crossing it to about every species in the secondary germplasm that we could get our hands on. This was done by the USDA sunflower breeder Brent Hulke, who's up at Fargo, and what he did, he decided what of all these secondary these perennial relatives in the secondary germplasm, how many of them can we generate large enough populations to evaluate? Can we start a breeding program through evaluating all of these? Some of the seed was wild collected, but most of it was, you went to Grint and you said, okay, let's try different populations, let's start crossing. Helianthus tuberosus worked the best. We were able to generate really big populations to evaluate. That's not surprising if you know sunflower, but it worked great. So we started, you know, we generated these perennial hybrids, we evaluated them, tried different breeding strategies, back crossing, just direct domestication. We decided that the best way eventually was to stay with these tetraploid hybrids and just intermate and select for the things that we like. Big seed size, big head size, doesn't look like a sunflower bush, you know, things that make it agronomically useful. And hopefully we'll get down to here, you know, a final product that's perennial. But this system isn't really important. What's important is how it's created collaborations and how we've been able to grow this program, right, and as an example. So we started, really, with a plant breeding program. We decided, you know, a pre-breeding program really is what you had. Let's try and see how many different things we can see. So initially, it was just something that was done in the lab because it seemed like a good idea. Then we go to the National Sunflower Association, the meetings in Fargo. We talk to all the growers in a stakeholder engagement piece, and really what they say, what they funded us to work on was blackbirds. Blackbirds devastate sunflower crops, particularly hybrid seed production. And a lot of work that had been done by the USDA Wildlife Service had found that if you plant trap crops, that they of course wouldn't attack your commercial sunflower fields. But the economics didn't work out if you had to replant annually every year. But when we started talking, if you only had to replant every 5 years, the economics make sense. So then we started working with them. Dr. George Linz, who just retired this year, which is really too bad. We started working with them. So we've gone back, and while we're interested in it as an oil seed, that's not what the farmers are. So we adjust the phenotypes that we're looking for. We adjust how, you know, the crossing scheme, what environments we're testing in, and you can move forward with that. And then, you know, in the same vein, it leads to these different agronomic studies. We cared slightly differently about what our phenotypes are and how we're looking at that, what soils, you know, because now if we're targeting trap crops, it's going to be on much more marginal soils, much more marginal environments. So how are we going to do that? So then we start, you know, and part of that then you have to add in a policy analysis, you know, how does crop insurance work if you're going to be a perennial, how, and all these things. And then we start adding other things as we start thinking about other crops. Molecular genetic analysis, food science, does it have forage quality, is it their potential biofuel, you know, ecological niche modeling. So it rapidly, like any research program, right, it balloons, it gets giant, and it starts thinking, how can we deal with all these things? Well, you had your initial studies that were done at the University of Minnesota. They were done by Brent, who is the USDA sunflower breeder, but they were done when I was a graduate student. And he also worked heavily with the Land Institute down in Kansas, working on some of these agroecosystems. So after he graduated, right, as most graduate students, you don't want your project to die. You want it to live on, right? You want people to keep caring, right? And so when he moved to the ARS and as an adjunct professor in North Dakota, he kept the program going. And then I came on, right? So I started working on it. We made progress. We got a number of grants from the growers, and we started working. And we were like, oh, we're making some progress. We're really seeing some interesting things. But there's some issues on the genetic side dealing with a polyploid that an autoallopolyploid. There are issues, right? Very fun system, but there are issues. So what did we do? We went and talked to UBC. So UBC is sequencing the sunflower genome. A professor by the name of Lauren Riesberg has been spearheading the sunflower genome, which should be out any time now. But we talked to him, you know, in kind of one of these webs. One of his former graduate students is on faculty at University of Minnesota, so we sent him a message saying, you know, can we work with you? And then that's how I ended up going up there. And you start working, and now we have, you know, we're actually now starting to sequence one of the perennial relatives, going to get a whole genome sequence. We already, you know, built a transcriptome. And so in this just small example, one of the 10 species where we have where a breeding program has been initiated, now you know, now you're dealing with, six different players in this particular project, which is, you know, that has also now led to, a PhD dissertation, two postdocs being hired, they're hiring a master's student. You know, you're able to kind of build these things up in a way, starting from the premise, right, that you're able to convince people to, that you can get the your local community to really care about a specific issue. In this case, that was water quality, right? Water quality was what people would latch onto here, specifically, and that was able to kind of push this forward, and in the case, and it's all based kind of on our botanical understanding of how do we pick our species? We pick our species completely based on looking at what are the crop wild relatives of that species. We start looking at the ethnobotanical record. Okay, are any of these useful? And then we move up from there, and the ability to the tractability of the way that resources have been developed, you can develop resources, has really allowed us to leverage a lot of those things. So that's a small example. It's actually been formalized, actually, by some of our colleagues in the geography department in trying to think of a way. They call it the reflective plant breeding paradigm. And what they're doing here is they're really trying to figure out how can you do everything at once. This was work done by Brian Runk. It was published in Crop Science last year. But really, the whole idea is, can you develop an economically viable crop working with farmers at the same time that you're doing an agronomic study, at the same time you're developing a breeding program, at the same time you're developing molecular resources? And really what's happened is it's all tractable now to kind of start all of these enterprises running at the same time when working on a species that hasn't been, that doesn't have the resources of something like a wheat, like a maize, like a sunflower, where there is this history. Even in the, pennycress is a great example in this case. When they started working on it, about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, they have a genome. They have now gone actually to GRIN, and they have the entire, they're planting out as an association panel every accession that's left that's in GRIN. They're going to genotype that entire collection. And now you're on par with the resources in very, very well-developed systems, and yet you've developed these resources in 5 years. And it's gonna, and the idea is that it'll fit a very useful ecological niche in, the northern U.S. here, or southern Canada, right? So it's kind of this idea of how can we use all of these different types of knowledge together, and how can you go about doing that by working with a large group of people? So, just because I like pictures, and apparently I like collages, this is just some of the people who've been involved, right? So one of the things I want to pull out a few of these and talk to you about how we've interacted with them. So one of the prominent ones there, I don't have a laser pointer. You guys can hear me, right? So I'm gonna jump down. But so this is the White Earth Nation. It's a Native American group in Minnesota here that Don has been working with for 25 years, and they developed a three-way partnership working looking at plants that were very important to the Ojibwe there on White Earth. They're working now with Estee Lauder and the University of Minnesota to look at things grown on the tribe for antimicrobial and antioxidant activity. So it's something now that partnership there, right, has brought in the law school because they're trying to deal with the intellectual property rights. It's brought in the Native American Studies Department. It's brought in the Geography Department. It's brought in the Tribal College. And it's from that one, initial kind of ethnobotanical exploration there that was done in the late 90s, it's kind of ballooned into this big project. The Land Institute, of course, has been a big player in all this. Don has collaborated with them for years. Also, Lee DeHaan, who's the intermediate wheatgrass breeder there. It started with these ideas of let's perennialize it, but then let's look at crossing wheat to its perennial relatives. Let's look at domestication, they're developing a genome. They're trying to genotype the entire germplasm collection. They're trying to figure out how do we take all of this knowledge that we have and move it forward. We know that the ex situ conservation centers are such great resources. How do we use them in a way that we can immediately get, not immediately, but in a shorter time frame, instead of 20 years, instead of 15 years, can we get it out there in 3 years, 6 years? Something that a farmer can actually grow for an economic gain. And in this case, it's regionally developed to the upper Midwest, but you can easily imagine how you could use some of those same ideas to work pretty much to kind of work in many different contexts, as long as you can initially assess that information. It's about how can we compress the time needed to develop a new crop that's going to be economically viable for a farmer. And it all starts, with do we have those resources and how can we use them in a way to really explore or to know what plants to cross, to know what exactly, the example of the wild cat, right? Well, what part of the wildcat do we want? What part don't we want? And can we then use our increasingly cheap technologies to integrate those specific regions into our plants, or even to just more efficiently select our wild plants and grow them? So with that, any questions, guys? In my lack of maroon and gold, I'm just saying. More of a Wisconsin badger. That's really kind of blasphemous. I'm sorry. But questions, guys? Yeah?
In the slide that you showed on reflective migrating,
yeah.
Could you plug that into the genetic gain equation?
Yes. So,
how would that look?
So if I was going to interpret it in terms of genetic gain, I think what you really want to do is you want to incorporate your various, in this case, what I would like to do is probably incorporate it in terms of a genomic selection model where your phenotypes are going to be defined by the farmers. And so if you can define your phenotypes and just get more cycles per year and kind of continuously do that, if you can better define your phenotypes, you're not going to release something that people aren't terribly interested in. So I can think about it in terms of different types of, you can think of your favorite selection model, right? But I think it's really, we're not necessarily sure, we have our idea of what our phenotypes are. Like, I know what I want my phenotype to be in the sunflower. I want a big sunflower head with tubers. But, that might not be the most, that might not be the most useful phenotype. And it wasn't, right, to the growers. The growers don't care about having a perennial sunflower, per se, right? They care about having a trap crop for their blackbirds. And for the blackbirds, maybe the best phenotype is just synchronous flowering or even maybe asynchronous flowering across a wide time period so they can keep coming back to that same place for feed. And I think getting that continuous feedback and trying to build that into your into when you make your selections. So I guess for me in the sunflower, and I have to admit, I didn't do a good job of this. I would go to the field days. I'd go to the grower meeting once a year, right? And that's where you'd really talk to people. But ideally, right, what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to kind of have that be maybe once every month, every 2 months, where you're really, well, you wouldn't be once every month. It would be once every, as soon as you have your growth cycle, when you're going to make your selections, you want to talk. What are those phenotypes? Is this phenotype actually useful to you? Because when you're talking about new crops, it's not always clear what that phenotype is that's going to be most useful to a farmer.